cheeks is unmistakable.
Wouldn't you love to pull her back out here and get a response?
Caesar asks the audience. The crowd screams assent.
Sadly, rules are rules, and Katniss Everdeen's time has been spent.
Well, best of luck to you, Peter Mellark. And I think I speak for all of Panem when I say our hearts go with yours.
The roar of the crowd is deafening. Peter has absolutely wiped the rest of us off the map with his declaration of love for me. When the audience finally settles down, he chokes out a quiet, "Thank you," and returns to his seat. We stand for the anthem. I have to raise my head out of the required respect and cannot avoid seeing that every screen is now dominated by a shot of Peter and me, separated by a few feet that in the viewers' heads can never be breached. Poor, tragic us. But I know better. After the anthem, the tributes file back into the training center lobby and onto the elevators. I make sure to veer into a car that does not contain Peter. The crowd slows our entourages of stylists and mentors and chaperones, so we have only each other for company. No one speaks. My elevator stops to deposit four tributes before I am alone, and then find the doors opening on the 12th floor. Peter has only just stepped from his car when I slam my palms into his chest. He loses his balance and crashes into an ugly urn filled with fake flowers. The urn tips and shatters into hundreds of tiny pieces. Peter lands in the shards, and blood immediately flows from his hands.
"What was that for?" he says, aghast.
"You had no right to go saying those things about me," I shout at him. Now the elevator doors open, and the whole crew is there, Effie, Haymitch, Cinna, and Portia.
"What's going on?" says Effie, a note of hysteria in her voice. "Did you fall?"
"After she shoved me," says Peter, as Effie and Cinna help him up. Haymitch turns on me. "Shoved him?"
"This was your idea, wasn't it? Turning me into some kind of fool in front of the entire country?" I answer.
"It was my idea," says Peter,
wincing as he pulls spikes of pottery from his palms. "Haymitch just helped me with it."
"Yes, Haymitch is very helpful. To you," I say.
"You are a fool,"
Haymitch says in disgust.
"Do you think he hurt you? That boy just gave you something you could never achieve on your own."
"He made me look weak," I say.
"He made you look desirable, and let's face it, you can use all the help you can get in that department. You were about as romantic as dirt until he said he wanted you. Now they all do. You're all they're talking about, the star-crossed lovers from District 12,
says Haymitch. "But we're not star-crossed lovers," I say. Haymitch grabs my shoulders and pins me against the wall.
"Who cares? It's all a big show. It's all how you're perceived. The most I could say about you after your interview was that you were nice enough, although that in itself was a small miracle.
Now I can say you're a heartbreaker. Oh, 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 how the boys back home fall longingly at your feet. Which do you think will get you more sponsors?"
The smell of wine on his breath makes me sick. I shove his hands off my shoulders and step away, trying to clear my head. Cinna comes over and puts his arms around me.
"He's right, Katniss."
I don't know what to think.
"I should have been told, so I didn't look so stupid."
"No, your reaction was perfect. If you'd known, it wouldn't have read as real," says Portia.
"She's just worried about her boyfriend," says Peter gruffly, tossing away a bloody piece of the urn.
My cheeks burn again at the thought of Gale. I don't have a boyfriend.
"Whatever," says Peter. "But I bet he's smart enough to know a bluff when he sees it. Besides, you didn't say you loved me, so what does it matter?"
The words are sinking in, my anger fading. I'm torn now between thinking I've been used and thinking I've been given an edge. Haymitch is right.
I survived my interview, but what was I really? A silly girl spinning in a sparkling dress, giggling. The only moment of any substance I had was when I talked about Prim. Compare that with Thresh, his silent, deadly power, and I'm forgettable, silly and sparkly and forgettable. No, not entirely forgettable. I have my 11 in training. But now Peeta has made me an object of love, not just his. To hear him tell it, I have many admirers. And if the audience really thinks we're in love, I remember how strongly they responded to his confession. Star-crossed lovers. Haymitch is right. They eat that stuff up in the capital. Suddenly I'm worried that I didn't react properly. After he said he loved me, did you think I could be in love with him too? I ask. I did, says Portia. The way you avoided looking at the cameras, the blush. The others chime in, agreeing.
You're golden, sweetheart. You're gonna have sponsors lined up around the block, says Haymitch.
I'm embarrassed about my reaction. I force myself to acknowledge Peeta. I'm sorry I shoved you.
Doesn't matter, he shrugs, although it's technically illegal.
Are your hands okay? I ask.
They'll be all right, he says.
In the silence that follows, delicious smells of our dinner waft in from the dining room.
Come on, let's eat, says Haymitch.
We all follow him to the table and take our places. But then Peeta is bleeding too heavily, and Portia leads him off for medical treatment. We start the cream and rose petal soup without them. By the time we've finished, they're back. Peeta's hands are wrapped in bandages. I can't help feeling guilty. Tomorrow we will be in the arena. He has done me a favor, and I have answered with an injury. Will I never stop owing him? After dinner, we watch the replay in the sitting room. I seem frilly and shallow, twirling and giggling in my dress, although the others assure me I am charming. Peeta actually is charming, and then utterly winning as the boy in love. And there I am, blushing and confused, made beautiful by Cinna's hands, desirable by Peeta's confession, tragic by circumstance, and by all accounts, unforgettable. When the anthem finishes and the screen goes dark, a hush falls on the room. Tomorrow at dawn, we will be roused and prepared for the arena. The actual games don't start until 10, because so many of the capital residents rise late. But Peeta and I must make an early start. There is no telling how far we will travel to the arena that has been prepared for this year's games. I know Haymitch and Effie will not be going with us. As soon as they leave here, they'll be at the game's headquarters, hopefully madly signing up our sponsors, working out a strategy on how and when to deliver the gifts to us. Cinna and Portia will travel with us to the very spot from which we will be launched into the arena. Still, final goodbyes must be said here. Effie takes both of us by the hand, and with actual tears in her eyes, wishes us well, thanks us for being the best tributes it has ever been her privilege to sponsor. And then, because it's Effie, and she's apparently required by law to say something awful, she adds,
I wouldn't be at all surprised if I finally get promoted to a decent district next year.
Then she kisses us each on the cheek and hurries out, overcome with either the emotional parting or the possible improvement of her fortunes. Haymitch crosses his arms and looks us both over.
Any final words of advice? Asks Peeta. When the gong sounds, get the hell out of there. You're neither of you up for the bloodbath at the cornucopia. Just clear out. Put as much distance as you can between yourselves and the others, and find a source of water, he says. Got it?
And after that, I ask.
Stay alive, says Haymitch.
It's the same advice he gave us on the train, but he's not drunk and laughing this time, and we only nod. What else is there to say? When I head to my room, Peeta lingers to talk to Portia. I'm glad. Whatever strange words of parting we exchange can wait until tomorrow. My covers are drawn back, but there is no sign of the red-headed Avox girl. I wish I knew her name. I should have asked it. She could write it down, maybe, or act it out. But perhaps that would only result in punishment for her. I take a shower and scrub the gold paint, the makeup, the scent of beauty from my body. All that remains of the design team's efforts are the flames on my nails. I decide to keep them as a reminder of who I am to the audience. Katniss, the girl who was on fire. Perhaps it will give me something to hold on to in the days to come. I pull on a thick, fleecy nightgown and climb into bed. It takes me about 5 seconds to realize I'll never fall asleep. And I need sleep desperately, because in the arena, every moment I give in to fatigue will be an invitation to death. It's no good. 1 hour, 2, 3 pass, and my eyelids refuse to get heavy. I can't stop trying to imagine exactly what terrain I'll be thrown into. Desert, swamp, a frigid wasteland. Above all, I am hoping for trees, which may afford me some means of concealment and food and shelter. Often there are trees because barren landscapes are dull and the games resolve too quickly without them. But what will the climate be like? What traps have the game makers hidden to liven up the slower moments? And then there are my fellow tributes. The more anxious I am to find sleep, the more it eludes me. Finally, I am too restless to even stay in bed. I pace the floor, heart beating too fast, breathing too short. My room feels like a prison cell. If I don't get air soon, I'm going to start to throw things again. I run down the hall to the door to the roof. It's not only unlocked, but ajar. Perhaps someone forgot to close it, but it doesn't matter. The energy field enclosing the roof prevents any desperate form of escape. And I'm not looking to escape, only to fill my lungs with air. I want to see the sky and the moon on the last night that no one will be hunting me. The roof is not lit at night, but as soon as my bare feet reach the tiled surface, I see his silhouette, black against the lights that shine endlessly in the capital. There's quite a commotion going on down in the streets, music and singing and car horns, none of which I could hear through the thick glass window panels in my room. I could slip away now, without him noticing me. He wouldn't hear me over the din. But the night air's so sweet. I can't bear returning to that stuffy cage of a room. And what difference does it make, whether we speak or not? My feet move soundlessly across the tiles. I'm only a yard behind him when I say, "You should be getting some sleep." He starts, but doesn't turn. I can see him give his head a slight shake. "I didn't want to miss the party. It's for us, after all." I come up beside him and lean over the edge of the rail. The wide streets are full of dancing people. I squint to make out their tiny figures in more detail. Are they in costumes?
"Who could tell?" Peeta answers, "with all the crazy clothes they wear here. Couldn't sleep either?"
"Couldn't turn my mind off," I say.
"Thinking about your family?"
he asks. "No," I admit a bit guiltily. "All I can do is wonder about tomorrow, which is pointless, of course." In the light from below, I can see his face now, the awkward way he holds his bandaged hands. "I really am sorry about your hands."
"It doesn't matter, Katniss," he says. "I've never been a contender in these games anyway."
"That's no way to be thinking," I say.
"Why not? It's true. My best hope is to not disgrace myself and..."
He hesitates. "And what?" I say.
"I don't know how to say it exactly. Only, I want to die as myself. Does that make any sense?"
he asks. I shake my head. How could he die as anyone but himself?
"I don't want them to change me in there. Turn me into some kind of monster that I'm not."
I bite my lip, feeling inferior. While I've been ruminating on the availability of trees, Peeta has been struggling with how to maintain his identity, his purity of self. "Do you mean you won't kill anyone?" I ask.
"No, when it comes time, I'm sure I'll kill just like everybody else. I can't go down without a fight. Only I keep wishing I could think of a way to show the capital they don't own me, that I'm more than just a piece in their games," says Peter.
"But you're not," I say. "None of us are. That's how the games work."
"Okay, but within that framework, there's still you, there's still me," he insists. "Don't you see?"
"A little. Only, no offense, but who cares, Peter?" I say.
"I do. I mean, what else am I allowed to care about at this point?" he asks angrily. He's locked those blue eyes on mine now, demanding an answer.
I take a step back.
"Care about what Haymitch said, about staying alive."
Peter smiles at me, sad and mocking.
"Okay. Thanks for the tip, sweetheart."
It's like a slap in the face, his use of Haymitch's patronizing endearment.
"Look, if you want to spend the last hours of your life planning some noble death in the arena, that's your choice. I want to spend mine in District 12. "Wouldn't surprise me if you do," says Peter. "Give my mother my best when you make it back, will you?"
"Count on it," I say. Then I turn and leave the roof. I spend the rest of the night slipping in and out of a doze, imagining the cutting remarks I will make to Peter Mellark in the morning. Peter Mellark. We will see how high and mighty he is when he's faced with life and death. He'll probably turn into one of those raging beast tributes, the kind who tries to eat someone's heart after they've killed them. There was a guy like that a few years ago from District 6 called Titus. He went completely savage, and the game makers had to have him stunned with electric guns to collect the bodies of the players he'd killed before he ate them. There are no rules in the arena, but cannibalism doesn't play well with the capital audience, so they tried to head it off. There was some speculation that the avalanche that finally took Titus out was specifically engineered to ensure the victor was not a lunatic. I don't see Peter in the morning. Cinna comes to me before dawn, gives me a simple shift to wear, and guides me to the roof. My final dressing and preparations will be done in the catacombs under the arena itself. A hovercraft appears out of thin air, just like the one did in the woods the day I saw the red-headed Avox girl captured, and a ladder drops down. I place my hands and feet on the lower rungs, and instantly it's as if I'm frozen. Some sort of current glues me to the ladder, while I'm lifted safely inside. I expect the ladder to release me then, but I'm still stuck when a woman with a white coat approaches me carrying a syringe.
"This is just your tracker, Katniss. The stiller you are, the more efficiently I can place it," she says.
Still? I'm a statue. But it doesn't prevent me from feeling the sharp stab of pain as the needle inserts the metal tracking device deep under the skin on the inside of my forearm. Now the game makers will always be able to trace my whereabouts in the arena. Wouldn't want to lose a tribute.
As soon as the tracker's in place, the ladder releases me. The woman disappears and Cinna is retrieved from the roof. An Avox boy comes in and directs us to a room where breakfast has been laid out. Despite the tension in my stomach, I eat as much as I can, although none of the delectable food makes any impression on me. I'm so nervous I could be eating coal dust. The one thing that distracts me at all is the view from the windows as we sail over the city and then to the wilderness beyond. This is what birds see, only they're free and safe, the very opposite of me. The ride lasts about half an hour before the windows black out, suggesting that we're nearing the arena. The hovercraft lands, and Cinna and I go back to the ladder. Only this time, it leads down into a tube underground, into the catacombs that lie beneath the arena. We follow instructions to my destination, a chamber for my preparation. In the capital, they call it the launch room. In the districts, it's referred to as the stockyard, the place animals go before slaughter. Everything is brand new. I will be the first and only tribute to use this launch room. The arenas are historic sites, preserved after the games, popular destinations for capital residents to visit, to vacation, go for a month, rewatch the games, tour the catacombs, visit the sites where the deaths took place. You can even take part in reenactments. They say the food is excellent. I struggle to keep my breakfast down as I shower and clean my teeth. Cinna does my hair in my simple trademark braid down my back. Then the clothes arrive. The same for every tribute. Cinna has no say in my outfit, does not even know what will be in the package. But he helps me dress in the undergarments. Simple tawny pants, light green blouse, sturdy brown belt, and thin hooded black jacket that falls to my thighs. The material in the jacket's designed to reflect body heat. Expect some cool nights, he says. The boots, worn over skin-tight socks, are better than I could have hoped for. Soft leather, not unlike my ones at home. These have a narrow, flexible rubber sole with treads, though. Good for running. I think I'm finished when Cinna pulls the gold Mockingjay pin from his pocket. I had completely forgotten about it. Where did you get that? I ask. Off the green outfit you wore on the train, he says. I remember now taking it off my mother's dress, pinning it to the shirt. It's your district token, right? I nod, and he fastens it on my shirt. It barely cleared the review board. Some thought the pin could be used as a weapon, giving you an unfair advantage. But eventually, they let it through, says Cinna. They eliminated a ring from that District 1 girl, though. If you twisted the gemstone, a spike popped out. Poisoned one. She claimed she had no knowledge the ring transformed, and there was no way to prove she did. But she lost her token. There. You're all set. Move around. Make sure everything feels comfortable. I walk, run in a circle, swing my arms about. Yes, it's fine. Fits perfectly. Then there's nothing to do but wait for the call, says Cinna. Unless you think you could eat any more. I turn down food, but accept a glass of water that I take tiny sips of as we wait on a couch. I don't want to chew on my nails or lips, so I find myself gnawing on the inside of my cheek. It still hasn't fully healed from a few days ago. Soon the taste of blood fills my mouth. Nervousness seeps into terror as I anticipate what is to come. I could be dead, flat out dead, in an hour. Not even. My fingers obsessively trace the hard little lump on my forearm where the woman injected the tracking device. I press on it, even though it hurts. I press on it so hard, a small bruise begins to form. "Do you want to talk, Katniss?" Cinna asks. I shake my head, but after a moment, hold out my hand to him. Cinna encloses it in both of his. And this is how we sit, until a pleasant female voice announces it's time to prepare for launch. Still clenching one of Cinna's hands, I walk over and stand on the circular metal plate. "Remember what Haymitch said. Run. Find water. The rest will follow," he says. I nod. "And remember this. I'm not allowed to bet, but if I could, my money would be on you." "Truly?" I whisper. "Truly," says Cinna. He leans down and kisses me on the forehead. "Good luck, girl on fire." And then a glass cylinder is lowering around me, breaking our handhold, cutting him off from me. He taps his fingers under his chin, head high. I lift my chin and stand as straight as I can. The cylinder begins to rise. For maybe 15 seconds, I'm in darkness, and then I can feel the metal plate pushing me out of the cylinder into the open air. For a moment, my eyes are dazzled by the bright sunlight, and I'm conscious only of a strong wind with the hopeful smell of pine trees. Then I hear the legendary announcer Claudius Templesmith as his voice booms all around me. "Ladies and gentlemen,
Let the 74th Hunger Games begin!
Chapter 11. 60 seconds. That's how long we're required to stand on our metal circles before the sound of a gong releases us. Step off before the minute is up, and landmines blow your legs off. 60 seconds to take in the ring of tributes all equidistant from the cornucopia. A giant golden horn shaped like a cone with a curved tail, the mouth of which is at least 20 feet high, spilling over with the things that will give us life here in the arena. Food, containers of water, weapons, medicine, garments, fire starters. Strewn around the cornucopia are other supplies, their value decreasing the farther they are from the horn. For instance, only a few steps from my feet lays a 3-foot square of plastic. Certainly it could be of some use in a downpour. But there in the mouth, I can see a tent pack that would protect from almost any sort of weather, if I had the guts to go in and fight for it against the other 23 tributes, which I have been instructed not to do. We're on a flat, open stretch of ground, a plain of hard-packed dirt. Behind the tributes across from me, I can see nothing, indicating either a steep downward slope or even a cliff. To my right lies a lake. To my left and back, sparse, piney woods. This is where Haymitch would want me to go, immediately. I hear his instructions in my head. Just clear out, put as much distance as you can between yourselves and the others, and find a source of water. But it's tempting, so tempting, when I see the bounty waiting there before me. And I know that if I don't get it, someone else will. That the career tributes who survive the bloodbath will divide up most of these life-sustaining spoils. Something catches my eye. There, resting on a mound of blanket rolls, is a silver sheath of arrows and a bow, already strung, just waiting to be engaged. That's mine, I think. It's meant for me. I'm fast. I can sprint faster than any of the girls in our school, although a couple can beat me in distance races. But this 40-yard length, this is what I am built for. I know I can get it. I know I can reach it first. But then the question is, how quickly can I get out of there? By the time I've scrambled up the packs and grabbed the weapons, others will have reached the horn, and one or two I might be able to pick off. But say there's a dozen at that close range. They could take me down with the spears and the clubs, or their own powerful fists. Still, I won't be the only target. I'm betting many of the other tributes would pass up a smaller girl, even one who scored an 11 in training, to take out their more fierce adversaries. Haymitch has never seen me run. Maybe if he had, he'd tell me to go for it, get the weapon. Since that's the very weapon that might be my salvation. And I only see one bow in that whole pile. I know the minute must be almost up, and will have to decide what my strategy will be, and I find myself positioning my feet to run, not away into the surrounding forests, but toward the pile, toward the bow. When suddenly I notice Peter. He's about 5 tributes to my right, quite a fair distance. Still, I can tell he's looking at me, and I think he might be shaking his head. But the sun's in my eyes, and while I'm puzzling over it, the gong rings out. And I've missed it. I've missed my chance, because those extra couple of seconds I've lost by not being ready are enough to change my mind about going in. My feet shuffle for a moment, confused at the direction my brain wants to take, and then I lunge forward, scoop up the sheet of plastic and a loaf of bread. The pickings are so small, and I'm so angry with PETA for distracting me, that I sprint in 20 yards to retrieve a bright orange backpack that could hold anything, because I can't stand leaving with virtually nothing. A boy, I think from District 9, reaches the pack at the same time I do, and for a brief time we grapple for it, and then he coughs, splattering my face with blood. I stagger back, repulsed by the warm, sticky spray. Then the boy slips to the ground,
That's when I see the knife in his back. Already other tributes have reached the cornucopia and are spreading out to attack. Yes, the girl from District 2, 10 yards away, running toward me, one hand clutching a half-dozen knives. I've seen her throw in training. She never misses. And I'm her next target. All the general fear I've been feeling condenses into an immediate fear of this girl, this predator who might kill me in seconds. Adrenaline shoots through me, and I sling the pack over one shoulder and run full speed for the woods. I can hear the blade whistling towards me, and reflexively hike the pack up to protect my head. The blade lodges in the pack, both straps on my shoulders now. I make for the trees. Somehow I know the girl will not pursue me, that she'll be drawn back into the cornucopia before all the good stuff is gone. A grin crosses my face. Thanks for the knife, I think. At the edge of the woods, I turn for one instant to survey the field. About a dozen or so tributes are hacking away at one another at the horn. Several lie dead already on the ground. Those who have taken flight are disappearing into the trees or into the void opposite me. I continue running until the woods have hidden me from the other tributes, then slow into a steady jog that I think I can maintain for a while. For the next few hours, I alternate between jogging and walking, putting as much distance as I can between myself and my competitors. I lost my bread during the struggle with the boy from District 9. But managed to stuff my plastic in my sleeve, so as I walk, I fold it neatly and tuck it into a pocket. I also free the knife. It's a fine one with a long, sharp blade serrated near the handle, which will make it handy for sawing through things, and slide it into my belt. I don't dare stop to examine the contents of the pack yet. I just keep moving, pausing only to check for pursuers. I can go a long time. I know that from my days in the woods, but I will need water. That was Haymitch's second instruction, and since I sort of botched the first, I keep a sharp eye out for any sign of it. No luck. The woods begin to evolve, and the pines are intermixed with a variety of trees, some I recognize, some completely foreign to me. At one point, I hear a noise and pull my knife, thinking I may have to defend myself. But I've only startled a rabbit. "Good to see you," I whisper. If there's one rabbit, there could be hundreds just waiting to be snared. The ground slopes down. I don't particularly like this. Valleys make me feel trapped. I want to be high, like in the hills around District 12, where I can see my enemies approaching. But I have no choice but to keep going. Funny, though, I don't feel too bad. The days of gorging myself have paid off. I've got staying power, even though I'm short on sleep. Being in the woods is rejuvenating. I'm glad for the solitude, even though it's an illusion, because I'm probably on screen right now. Not consistently, but off and on. There are so many deaths to show the first day that a tribute trekking through the woods isn't much to look at. But they'll show me enough to let people know I'm alive, uninjured, and on the move. One of the heaviest days of betting is the opening, when the initial casualties come in. But that can't compare to what happens as the field shrinks to a handful of players. It's late afternoon when I begin to hear the cannons. Each shot represents a dead tribute. The fighting must have finally stopped at the cornucopia. They never collect the bloodbath bodies until the killers have dispersed. On the opening day, they don't even fire the cannons until the initial fighting's over because it's too hard to keep track of the fatalities. I allow myself to pause, panting, as I count the shots. 1, 2, 3, on and on, until they reach 11. 11 dead in all. 13 left to play. My fingernails scrape at the dried blood the boy from District 9 coughed into my face. He's gone, certainly. I wonder about Peter. Has he lasted through the day? I'll know in a few hours, when they project the dead's images into the sky for the rest of us to see.
All of a sudden, I'm overwhelmed by the thought that Peter may be already lost, bled white, collected, and in the process of being transported back to the capital to be cleaned up, redressed, and shipped in a simple wooden box back to District 12. No longer here, heading home. I try hard to remember if I saw him once the action started, but the last image I can conjure up is Peter shaking his head as the gong rang out. Maybe it's better if he's gone already. He had no confidence he could win, and I will not end up with the unpleasant task of killing him. Maybe it's better if he's out of this for good. I slump down next to my pack, exhausted. I need to go through it anyway before night falls. See what I have to work with. As I unhook the straps, I can feel it's sturdily made, although a rather unfortunate color. This orange will practically glow in the dark. I make a mental note to camouflage it first thing tomorrow. I flip open the flap. What I want most, right in this moment, is water. Haymitch's directive to immediately find water was not arbitrary. I won't last long without it. For a few days, I'll be able to function with unpleasant symptoms of dehydration. But after that, I'll deteriorate into helplessness and be dead in a week tops. I carefully lay out the provisions. One thin black sleeping bag that reflects body heat, a pack of crackers, a pack of dried beef strips, a bottle of iodine, a box of wooden matches, a small coil of wire, a pair of sunglasses, and a half-gallon plastic bottle with a cap for carrying water that's bone dry. No water. How hard would it have been for them to fill up the bottle? I become aware of the dryness in my throat and mouth, the cracks in my lips. I've been moving all day long. It's been hot, and I've sweat a lot. I do this at home, but there are always streams to drink from, or snow to melt if it should come to it. As I refill my pack, I have an awful thought. The lake, the one I saw while I was waiting for the gong to sound. What if that's the only water source in the arena? That way they'll guarantee drawing us in to fight. The lake is a full day's journey from where I sit now, a much harder journey with nothing to drink. And then, even if I reach it, it's sure to be heavily guarded by some of the career tributes. I'm about to panic when I remember the rabbit I startled earlier today. It has to drink, too. I just have to find out where. Twilight is closing in, and I'm ill at ease. The trees are too thin to offer much concealment. The layer of pine needles that muffles my footsteps also makes tracking animals harder when I need their trails to find water. And I'm still heading downhill, deeper and deeper into a valley that seems endless. I'm hungry, too, but I don't dare break into my precious store of crackers and beef yet. Instead, I take my knife and go to work on a pine tree, cutting away the outer bark and scraping off a large handful of the softer inner bark. I slowly chew the stuff as I walk along. After a week of the finest food in the world, it's a little hard to choke down. But I've eaten plenty of pine in my life. I'll adjust quickly. In another hour, it's clear I've got to find a place to camp. Night creatures are coming out. I can hear the occasional hoot or howl, my first clue that I'll be competing with natural predators for the rabbits. As to whether I'll be viewed as a source of food, it's too soon to tell. There could be any number of animals stalking me at this moment. But right now, I decide to make my fellow tributes a priority. I'm sure many will continue hunting through the night. Those who fought it out at the cornucopia will have food, an abundance of water from the lake, torches or flashlights, and weapons they're itching to use. I can only hope I've traveled far and fast enough to be out of range. Before settling down, I take my wire and set two twitch-up snares in the brush. I know it's risky to be setting traps, but food will go so fast out here, and I can't set snares on the run. Still, I walk another 5 minutes before making camp. I pick my tree carefully, a willow,
not terribly tall, but set in a clump of other willows, offering concealment in those long, flowing tresses. I climb up, sticking to the stronger branches close to the trunk, and find a sturdy fork for my bed. It takes some doing, but I arrange the sleeping bag in a relatively comfortable manner. I place my backpack in the foot of the bag, then slide in after it. As a precaution, I remove my belt, loop it all the way around the branch and my sleeping bag, and refasten it at my waist. Now, if I roll over in my sleep, I won't go crashing to the ground. I'm small enough to tuck the top of the bag over my head, but I put on my hood as well. As night falls, the air is cooling quickly. Despite the risk I took in getting the backpack, I know now it was the right choice. This sleeping bag, radiating back and preserving my body heat, will be invaluable. I'm sure there are several other tributes whose biggest concern right now is how to stay warm, whereas I may actually be able to get a few hours of sleep. If only I wasn't so thirsty. Night has just come when I hear the anthem that precedes the death recap. Through the branches I can see the seal of the capital, which appears to be floating in the sky. I'm actually viewing another screen, an enormous one, that's transported by one of their disappearing hovercraft. The anthem fades out, and the sky goes dark for a moment. At home, we would be watching full coverage of each and every killing. But that's thought to give an unfair advantage to the living tributes. For instance, if I got my hands on the bow and shot someone, my secret would be revealed to all. No, here in the arena, all we see are the same photographs they showed when they televised our training scores. Simple headshots. But now, instead of scores, they post only district numbers. I take a deep breath as the faces of the 11 dead tributes begin and tick them off one by one on my fingers. The first to appear is the girl from District 3. That means that the career tributes from 1 and 2 have all survived. No surprise there. Then the boy from 4. I didn't expect that one. Usually all the careers make it through the first day. The boy from District 5. I guess the fox-faced girl made it. Both tributes from 6 and 7. The boy from 8. Both from 9. Yes, there's the boy who I fought for the backpack. I've run through my fingers. Only one more dead tribute to go. Is it Peter? No. There's the girl from District 10. That's it. The Capitol Seal is back with a final musical flourish, then darkness, and the sounds of the forest resume. I'm relieved Peter's alive. I tell myself again that if I get killed, his winning will benefit my mother and Prim the most. This is what I tell myself to explain the conflicting emotions that arise when I think of Peter. The gratitude that he gave me an edge by professing his love for me in the interview. The anger at his superiority on the roof. The dread that we may come face to face at any moment in this arena. 11 dead, but none from District 12. I try to work out who is left. 5 career tributes. Foxface. Thresh. And Rue. Rue! So she made it through the first day after all. I can't help feeling glad. That makes 10 of us. The other 3 I'll figure out tomorrow. Now when it is dark, and I have traveled far, and I am nestled high in this tree, now I must try and rest. I haven't really slept in 2 days, and then there's been the long day's journey into the arena. Slowly, I allow my muscles to relax, my eyes to close. The last thing I think is it's lucky I don't snore. Snap! The sound of a breaking branch wakes me. How long have I been asleep? 4 hours? 5? The tip of my nose is icy cold. Snap! Snap! What's going on? This is not the sound of a branch under someone's foot, but the sharp crack of one coming from a tree. Snap! Snap! I judge it to be several hundred yards to my right. Slowly, noiselessly, I turn myself in that direction. For a few minutes,
There's nothing but blackness and some scuffling. Then I see a spark, and a small fire begins to bloom. A pair of hands warms over flames, but I can't make out more than that. I have to bite my lip not to scream every foul name I know at the fire starter. What are they thinking? A fire lit just at nightfall would have been one thing. Those who battled at the cornucopia, with their superior strength and surplus of supplies, they couldn't possibly have been near enough to spot the flames then. But now, when they've probably been combing the woods for hours looking for victims, you might as well be waving a flag and shouting, "Come and get me!" And here I am, a stone's throw from the biggest idiot in the games, strapped in a tree, not daring to flee since my general location has just been broadcast to any killer who cares. I mean, I know it's cold out here and not everybody has a sleeping bag, but then you grit your teeth and stick it out until dawn. I lay smoldering in my bag for the next couple of hours, really thinking that if I can get out of this tree, I won't have the least problem taking out my new neighbor. My instinct has been to flee, not fight. But obviously this person's a hazard. Stupid people are dangerous. And this one probably doesn't have much in the way of weapons, while I've got this excellent knife. The sky is still dark, but I can feel the first signs of dawn approaching. I'm beginning to think we, meaning the person whose death I'm now devising and me, we might actually have gone unnoticed. Then I hear it. Several pairs of feet breaking into a run. The fire starter must have dozed off. They're on her before she can escape. I know it's a girl now. I can tell by the pleading, the agonized scream that follows. Then there's laughter and congratulations from several voices. Someone cries out,
12 down and 11 to go,
which gets a round of appreciative hoots. So they're fighting in a pack. I'm not really surprised. Often alliances are formed in the early stages of the games. The strong band together to hunt down the weak, then, when the tension becomes too great, begin to turn on one another. I don't have to wonder too hard who has made this alliance. It will be the remaining career tributes from districts 1, 2, and 4. 2 boys and 3 girls. The ones who lunch together. For a moment, I hear them checking the girl for supplies. I can tell by their comments they've found nothing good. I wonder if the victim is Rue, but quickly dismiss the thought. She's much too bright to be building a fire like that.
Better clear out so they can get the body before it starts stinking.
I'm almost certain that's the brutish boy from District 2. There are murmurs of assent, and then, to my horror, I hear the pack heading toward me. They do not know I'm here. How could they? And I'm well concealed in the clump of trees, at least while the sun stays down. Then my black sleeping bag will turn from camouflage to trouble. If they just keep moving, they will pass me and be gone in a minute. But the careers stop in the clearing about 10 yards from my tree. They have flashlights, torches. I can see an arm here, a boot there, through the breaks in the branches. I turn to stone, not even daring to breathe. Have they spotted me? No, not yet. I can tell from their words their minds are elsewhere.
Shouldn't we have heard a cannon by now?
I'd say yes, nothing to prevent them from going in immediately.
Unless she isn't dead. She's dead. I stuck her myself.
Then where's the cannon?
Someone should go back, make sure the job's done.
Yeah, we don't want to have to track her down twice.
I said she's dead.
An argument breaks out until one tribute silences the others. We're wasting time. I'll go finish her and let's move on. I almost fall out of the tree. The voice belongs to Peter. Chapter 12. Thank goodness I had the foresight to belt myself in. I've rolled sideways off the fork and am facing the ground, held in place by the belt, one hand and my feet straddling the pack inside my sleeping bag, braced against the trunk. There must have been some rustling when I tipped sideways.
but the careers have been too caught up in their own argument to catch it.
"Go on, then, lover boy," says the boy from District 2. "See for yourself."
I just get a glimpse of Peter, lit by a torch, heading back to the girl by the fire. His face is swollen with bruises. There's a bloody bandage on one arm, and from the sound of his gait, he's limping somewhat. I remember him shaking his head, telling me not to go into the fight for the supplies, when all along, he'd planned to throw himself into the thick of things, just the opposite of what Haymitch had told him to do. Okay, I can stomach that. Seeing all those supplies was tempting. But this other thing, this teaming up with the career wolf pack to hunt down the rest of us. No one from District 12 would think of doing such a thing. Career tributes are overly vicious, arrogant, better fed, but only because they're the capital's lapdogs. Universally, solidly hated by all but those from their own districts. I can imagine the things they're saying about him back home now. And Peter had the gall to talk to me about disgrace? Obviously, the noble boy on the rooftop was playing just one more game with me. But this will be his last. I will eagerly watch the night skies for signs of his death, if I don't kill him first myself. The career tributes are silent until he gets out of earshot, then use hushed voices.
Why don't we just kill him now and get it over with?
Let him tag along. What's the harm? And he's handy with that knife. Is he? That's news. What a lot of interesting things I'm learning about my friend Peter today.
Besides, he's our best chance of finding her.
It takes me a moment to register that the her they're referring to is me.
Why? You think she bought into that sappy romance stuff?
She might have. Seemed pretty simple-minded to me. Every time I think about her spinning around in that dress, I want to puke.
Wish we knew how she got that 11.
Bet you lover boy knows. The sound of Peter returning silences them.
Was she dead?
Asks the boy from District 2. No, but she is now, says Peter. Just then, the cannon fires. Ready to move on? The career pack sets off at a run just as dawn begins to break and birdsong fills the air. I remain in my awkward position, muscles trembling with exertion for a while longer, then hoist myself back onto my branch. I need to get down, to get going, but for a moment I lie there, digesting what I've heard. Not only is Peter with the careers, he's helping them find me. The simple-minded girl who has to be taken seriously because of her 11. Because she can use a bow and arrow, which Peter knows better than anyone. But he hasn't told them yet. Is he saving that information because he knows it's all that keeps him alive? Is he still pretending to love me for the audience? What is going on in his head? Suddenly, the birds fall silent. Then one gives a high-pitched warning call. A single note, just like the one Gail and I heard when the red-headed Avox girl was caught. High above the dying campfire, a hovercraft materializes. A set of large metal teeth drops down. Slowly, gently, the dead tribute girl is lifted into the hovercraft. Then it vanishes. The birds resume their song.
Move,
I whisper to myself. I wriggle out of my sleeping bag, roll it up, and place it in the pack. I take a deep breath. While I've been concealed by darkness and the sleeping bag and the willow branches, it has probably been difficult for the cameras to get a good shot of me. I know they must be tracking me now, though. The minute I hit the ground, I'm guaranteed a close-up. The audience will have been beside themselves, knowing I was in the tree, that I overheard the careers talking, that I discovered Peter was with them. Until I work out exactly how I want to play that, I'd better at least act on top of things. Not perplexed, certainly not confused or frightened. No, I need to look one step ahead of the game. So as I slide out of the foliage and into the dawn light, I pause a second, giving the cameras time to lock on me. Then I cock my head slightly to the side and give a knowing smile. There,
Let them figure out what that means. I'm about to take off when I think of my snares. Maybe it's imprudent to check them with the others so close, but I have to. Too many years of hunting, I guess, and the lure of possible meat. I'm rewarded with one fine rabbit. In no time, I've cleaned and gutted the animal, leaving the head, feet, tail, skin, and innards under a pile of leaves. I'm wishing for a fire. Eating raw rabbit can give you rabbit fever, a lesson I learned the hard way. When I think of the dead tribute, I hurry back to her camp. Sure enough, the coals of her dying fire are still hot. I cut up the rabbit, fashion a spit out of branches, and set it over the coals. I'm glad for the cameras now. I want sponsors to see I can hunt. That I'm a good bet, because I won't be lured into traps as easily as the others will be by hunger. While the rabbit cooks, I grind up part of a charred branch and set about camouflaging my orange pack. The black tones it down, but I feel a layer of mud would definitely help. Of course, to have mud, I'd need water. I pull on my gear, grab my spit, kick some dirt over the coals, and take off in the opposite direction the careers went. I eat half the rabbit as I go, then wrap up the leftovers in my plastic for later. The meat stops the grumbling in my stomach, but does not quench my thirst. Water is my top priority now. As I hike along, I feel certain I'm still holding the screen in the Capitol, so I'm careful to continue to hide my emotions. But what a good time Claudius Templesmith must be having with his guest commentators, dissecting Peter's behavior, my reaction. What to make of it all? Has Peter revealed his true colors? How does this affect the betting odds? Will we lose sponsors? Do we even have sponsors? Yes, I feel certain we do, or at least did. Certainly Peter has thrown a wrench into our star-crossed lover dynamic. Or has he? Maybe, since he hasn't spoken much about me, we can still get some mileage out of it. Maybe people will think it's something we plotted together, if I seem like it amuses me now. The sun rises in the sky, and even through the canopy it seems overly bright. I coat my lips with some grease from the rabbit and try to keep from panting, but it's no use. It's only been a day, and I'm dehydrating fast. I try and think of everything I know about finding water. It runs downhill, so, in fact, continuing down into this valley isn't a bad thing. If I could just locate a game trail or spot a particularly green patch of vegetation, these might help me along. But nothing seems to change. There's just the slight gradual slope, the birds, the sameness of the trees. As the day wears on, I know I'm headed for trouble. What little urine I've been able to pass is a dark brown. My head is aching, and there's a dry patch on my tongue that refuses to moisten. The sun hurts my eyes, so I dig out my sunglasses, but when I put them on, they do something funny to my vision, so I just stuff them back in my pack. It's late afternoon when I think I've found help. I spot a cluster of berry bushes and hurry to strip the fruit, to suck the sweet juices from the skins. But just as I'm holding them to my lips, I get a hard look at them. What I thought were blueberries have a slightly different shape, and when I break open one, the insides are blood red. I don't recognize these berries. Perhaps they are edible, but I'm guessing this is some evil trick on the part of the game makers. Even the plant instructor in the training center made a point of telling us to avoid berries unless you were 100% sure they weren't toxic. Something I already knew. But I'm so thirsty it takes her reminder to give me the strength to fling them away. Fatigue is beginning to settle on me, but it's not the usual tiredness that follows a long hike. I have to stop and rest frequently, although I know the only cure for what ails me requires continued searching. I try a new tactic, climbing a tree as high as I dare in my shaky state, to look for any signs of water. But as far as I can see in any direction, there's the same unrelenting stretch of forest. Determined to go on until nightfall, I walk until I'm stumbling over my own feet. Exhausted, I haul myself up into a tree and belt myself in. I've no appetite, but I suck on a rabbit bone just to give my mouth something to do. Night falls, the anthem plays, and high in the sky I see the picture of the girl who was